We are going to jump into session number 3. How do we think about counseling those with OCD? What is that experience like? How do we design an exposure? And what's the purpose of that? How does that work? And kind of get into the heart of this now this afternoon. Any questions before we jump into that? You've had time to think about this over lunch a little bit. Are there any questions that are burning on anybody's mind before we dive into that? So I think that there are a number of reasons why that is so. The correlation between very good. Thank you, Dave, for reminding me. So the question was, there seems to be a stigma with taking mental health medications that's not associated with taking medical kinds of medications, and why is that? With diabetes, for example, there is a pretty direct correlation between taking insulin and the physiological result. We can take blood work, we can measure sugar levels, we can give you insulin, we can see that change. The physiological process is pretty well understood. With mental health medications, there is not that close connection between what happens when we take a mental health medication, an SSRI, for example, and the result. There are some things that we can measure, there are some things that we know, but it's not nearly as clear. And so that opens up the opportunity for controversy or for people to have differences of opinions. Another reason why that is so is because mental health is more closely related to who we are as people than diabetes, taking insulin, for example. So if you take a mental health med, it is a legitimate concern. If I'm over-medicated, how will this impact my personality, right? It's not like we just give insulin and then we measure how much you need and that's your particular dosage and we make adjustments. I don't mean to oversimplify somebody who struggles with their sugars. That can be quite a piece of work to figure out. So I'm not oversimplifying that. But with mental health meds, there's not that close correlation. And then also, it impacts who we are as people. So it seems like the stakes are higher if we make a mistake, for example. And I think those are two reasons, maybe not the only ones, but it's closer to who we are. Good question. Any of you want to respond to that question? Why do you think that's so? Yes. It's okay in our circles, Leon is saying, to be physically ill. It's not okay to be mentally ill. Yes, there's truth with that. Anybody else?
Does OCD just make itself known one day, or are there signs you can see early on that this is coming?
Good question. I would say that depends on the severity, and I have seen it happen both ways. So thank you. You're reminding me to repeat the question. The question was, does OCD appear one day, or are there signs that indicate this is something that's coming on and leading up to it? I would say I have seen both. So there are sudden onsets, something happens, or it just manifests very quickly and you suddenly see somebody having obsessive kinds of thoughts and then compulsive behaviors to manage that anxiety. I would expect, I don't know this, I haven't seen studies, but if I just think about the people that I've worked with, I would expect that it was more tendencies that developed over time. So people who are conscientious, right? I have a friend who doesn't give a hoot in the world about anything, and he can go out and do just about anything as an experiment, even if it's wrong, and not feel bad about it, and then look back, well, I'm not sure that was a good thing to do. He is not going to have OCD. You know, it's just not, you know. People who worry about what was the motives of my heart, did I sin, did I offend that person, conscientiously oriented, and maybe oversensitive conscience, those kinds of tendencies, you will see that. And they learn, without knowing that they're learning it, to manage that anxiety by engaging in compulsive behaviors, and that can reinforce the cycle, and then it can grow. So, again, I haven't seen studies on that. Anecdotally, the people that I've worked with, I've not seen the more sudden onset, but I do know that can happen. That does happen sometimes. One of the places where I have seen that is in postpartum depression. So in the hormonal changes that are going on for a woman after having a baby, we are seeing more and more OCD being triggered when you would expect to see a postpartum depression. And that tends to be a more sudden onset. So it doesn't always mean that there were none of those factors before, but seemingly not. And then suddenly it manifests when a woman's body is trying to readjust to all of those things. So that can happen. Other questions? Yes. Could it also manifest, could OCD also manifest in puberty? It's a good question. I would assume that it could. I'm just trying to think of the clients that I've worked with. So anecdotally, from my experience, I can't say that I have seen that in a way that I would say, okay, this person just hit puberty and now we're seeing OCD. Although, it wouldn't surprise me. Childhood onset, you're often going to see those things by 11, 12, 13, 14, which is when those hormonal changes are happening. So, yeah, I can't speak definitively because I haven't seen research on that, but wouldn't surprise me. Good question. Anybody else? One more, and then we'll jump into our material here. Can untreated strep throat bring on OCD? That's a good question, and I have to say I don't know. You've read some sources that would say that it could. Yeah, that would be interesting to see. I don't know that strep throat can bring on OCD, but if there's people out there who have done research in that, I would be certainly open to seeing it. My sense in most of the people that I've worked with is that there are these personality tendencies. God has given us all a personality. We all have strengths and weaknesses. And as those strengths develop, you know, some people are more prone to anxiety. Why is that? I don't know. You know, there are biological reasons. There are personality tendencies. There are ways that we respond to that then. And so, for most of the people that I've worked with, there's been kind of a development of that, most times in childhood, but sometimes in adulthood too. And it might be that they've not known what it was. You know, I just do these funny things, and then they get to be an adult, or they hear a talk like this, and it's like, oh, you know. That would probably be on the more mild end, because if it's bad, it really disrupts people's lives. And then they will ask for help. Okay. Session 3. I think my page numbers are different than yours, but if you turn to that, how do we counsel those with OCD? Now, I say here at the beginning that I think as people helpers, as pastors, we can be helpful in helping people who have OCD, especially if we have some of this understanding. But I don't want you to leave this talk today feeling like okay, now I know everything that I need to know. This person has OCD in my classroom, and so I am going to go home and tear into this. Read some more literature, do some more research, talk to some more people. If you have somebody like that, help them get to a therapist who's worked with this. You're not going to harm them, probably, if you have some basic information, but you'll help them get help faster, and you can learn along that process as they go. So don't shy away from trying to help them get help, but gather more information, increase your knowledge in working with these people. Common treatment forms, I'll start here just mentioning these, and then we'll jump in a little bit further as we go along and talk specifically about what they are. Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. Acceptance and commitment therapy is kind of a form of CBT. ACT, they call it, and then medication management of symptoms. If you go to any secular therapist for OCD, it's very likely that they're going to engage you in one of these particular kinds of therapy. And I would say, as a Christian who wants to work with people, I want to understand those therapies, and I want to integrate faith with them and use them in a way that helps people and supports their sense of who they are as a believer. So I'm going to start out talking by medication just a little bit. We're going to go this backwards and start at the bottom bullet point first, and then we're going to go from there. So see your doctor or encourage people who have OCD to see a doctor, see somebody who understands OCD. Don't take what I'm telling you here as a directive for how to prescribe medication, but I do want you to have a little basic understanding of how some of these medications work and why they might be helpful. So typically first line, when we say first line, it means what's most likely to be prescribed, the first thing a doctor is going to go to. So medications are classified, first, second, third, fourth line medications. When a psychiatrist prescribes medication, he'll look at what's most commonly used, first line. And then if that doesn't work, he'll try second line and third and fourth, so on. So typically SSRIs are first line, so fluvoxamine, Luvox, sertraline, Zoloft, fluoxetine, Prozac, paroxetine, Paxil, citalopram, Celexa. These are SSRIs. And the way they're commonly billed is that in the synapses, the ends between your neurons, there are neurochemicals in there. And so the electrical impulse comes down to the end of one neuron and has to jump across. And the neurochemicals that are released from the end of one neuron into that synapse modulate how quickly, the strength, the way that impulse jumps from one neuron to the other, and that impacts then the person's experience. Now, that theory, which has been taught for many, many years, we now have significant reason to suspect maybe it's not true. So we don't know, and we would have to take a full course in biochemistry to understand all the whys and the wherefores of why that is. We do know that SSRIs still do have a significant impact, and it's probably that they influence something that influences something that influences something that influences something, rather than that there's this direct correlation that we think that we understand between how much serotonin is in the synapse. When somebody has obsessive compulsive disorder, it does seem like taking a medication like an SSRI can have positive impact on those obsessive thoughts, the intensity of the obsessive thoughts, and their ability to learn new ways of thinking. Most of the research that's out there will say if somebody has OCD, you don't just put them on a medication, because that helps a few people, but not nearly as many people who get medication and counseling. And so when somebody comes to me with OCD and asks the question about medication, I will gauge how severe is this? How much is it impacting their life on a daily basis? If it's on the severe end, then I might recommend, and often they might already be on a medication. If it's more moderate or mild, I might let the question up to them. Do you want to try counseling first and see if we can engage these processes differently in your mind and see what helps, and then go on medication? And some people will make that choice, and some people will start out medication right away. So SSRIs impact serotonin in the brain. That seems to help sometimes with the depression that accompanies OCD. sometimes with lowering the intensity of the obsessions. Makes it a little bit easier for them to put their mind somewhere else. Generally with an SSRI, we ought to see improvement in 8 to 12 weeks. Sometimes it might take longer than that, maybe 6 months. So a good doctor should say, look, let's try a trial of this SSRI and see what benefits we get from that. There are some statistics out there that say 60%, as many as 60% will see improvement with the first trial of an SSRI. Fewer than 20%, one study says, will see improvement with medication alone. So that's not a very big percentage, which is why we need to learn different ways of thinking as well. Medication with CBT is most effective. 20% will not see any improvement with their first medication. So they might need to try another one, or they might need to try something that augments that. Common side effects of an SSRI, and this is in your manual, nervousness, insomnia, restlessness, nausea, diarrhea. Many of those will go away as the body gets used to the medication. And so we have this thing where we say you have the side effects first as you're getting up to the therapeutic dose, and if you can push through that, some of those side effects will go away, and then we get to the therapeutic level where you're actually experiencing benefit from the medication. So work with your doctor, and if side effects are bad, I have had some clients, I had one young man went on to an SSRI and it was too much. He was having side effects that were significant, and I can't remember in that case, but he talked with his doctor and they either went to something else or backed the dosage down, and then he was able to realize the benefit from that without the side effects. Sometimes, I have one here, slow discontinuation with doctor's recommendation. Sometimes people worry about, if I go off of an SSRI, what are the side effects, what are the withdrawal effects? And used to be with SSRIs, I think they would take you off over the period of a couple of weeks. There's some evidence now that if you go off of them more slowly, you're less likely to have that negative effect. So if you're on an SSRI and you want to go off of it, I would ask your doctor, can I do this a little bit more slowly? And I've been hearing more doctors saying that, yes, there's some benefit in doing that. You can eliminate some of those problems. Sometimes I have seen psychiatrists prescribe a benzodiazepine. So this would be like Klonopin or Ativan, Xanax. And they will use this in a variety of ways. I like to see it used PRN. So if the person is having really intense anxiety, using that in the moment to manage that panic attack or to manage that anxiety and get them down to a more manageable level. Benzos can be addictive. Generally, if you take them as prescribed, they're not. But I have seen some people who are taking this on a daily basis over and over and over again, and benzos work very quickly, but over time, that quickness wears off, and so people end up taking more and more. And so when people are taking 3 and 4 and 5 milligrams of that on a daily basis, prophylactically, just to keep them from getting anxious, I start to get concerned about whether that's good for them in the long term. And so with benzos, generally I've seen people prescribe them PRN to lower the anxiety, but then they need to be doing other things to manage that over the long haul. Antipsychotics, olanzapine, Zyprexa, ORAP, risperidone, risperdal. There's some thought that the OCD process can become a psychotic process, or it's almost borderline psychotic. And so we have some psychiatrists that are now prescribing antipsychotics for OCD. And I expect that that's maybe when an SSRI doesn't work or it's in a more extreme situation. And actually, somebody just came forward in the break and said that was their experience. I don't mean personally, but they knew somebody who was diagnosed with OCD and it didn't seem like the SSRIs worked, I think, if I remember. And so then an antipsychotic or a med for bipolar actually was effective in helping to reduce some of those symptoms. So I think there's probably a process like that going on. So occasionally with medication, you might need to experiment. Do that with a doctor's help. Don't just randomly make your own decisions. And some patients with OCD might be on medication for the rest of their life. Some will come off. Some will utilize during times of stress. do all with the direction of a doctor. I've seen all of those. People with OCD, especially if it's really difficult, might need to be on a medication for the rest of their life. But we don't have to make that decision now. Is it helpful? Is it not? I've had clients who have gone on and then learned new ways of thinking and were able to go off of it. And I've had clients who needed to be on it during significant times of stress, starting a new business, getting married, going on the mission field. Like, these are all good things, but they're stressful. And during times of stress, OCD will be worse. And so needed medication for a year or two during those times, but then could be off of it other times. I tend to be a minimalist when it comes to medication. That's just my personal bent, but there is a very necessary good place for it. So I don't like to see people being on more medication than they need, and I want to see them engaging counseling and other things so that we're not just relying on the medication. But I have had clients who medication was what allowed them a new sense, a new lease on life, because it brings that intensity down, and then you can engage the process of learning new ways of thinking, and maybe you don't need the medication then, maybe you do, but that's a mercy. Okay, counseling therapy session. I've already talked about this a little bit. What other factors are playing into what is going on for this person? When somebody comes in and maybe they are talking about OCD, maybe they're not, but you're trying to assess for it, it's important to ask, what else is going on in this person's life? Are there social, biological, spiritual concerns that could be impacting this individual? So the client that I talked about who was engaging in a pornography addiction, that's something that we want to address, because if you're doing that and feeling bad about that, that's going to raise your anxiety. That's a significant stressor in your life, and that's going to amp up the OCD stuff. So we can't just talk about the OCD experience. We have to treat both of those things. I find that it often takes a number of sessions for me as a counselor, as a psychologist, to begin to get a sense of, is this actually OCD or not? How intense is it? And I didn't talk about this earlier. We skipped over in the notes, but there are two assessments. One of them is the PDUA, and you could probably look it up online. I think it's available online, or if you buy this book, Tormenting Thoughts and Secret Rituals by Ian Osborne. It's 15, 20 years old. It has the PDUA in it. So I will not read this whole thing, but listen to some of these questions. It's an inventory that you go through and induce. I'm sorry. You go through and mark off how intensely am I experiencing these symptoms. So listen to a few of these things. I feel my hands are dirty when I touch money. I think even slight contact with bodily secretions, perspiration, saliva, for example, may contaminate my clothes or somehow harm me. I find it difficult to touch an object when I know it's been touched by strangers or by certain people. When doubts and worries come to my mind, I cannot rest until I have talked them over with a reassuring person. I tend to ask people to repeat the same things to me several times consecutively, even though I understand what they are saying the first time. I keep on checking things more often than necessary. Sometimes I'm not sure I have done things that in fact I know I have done. I have the impression I will never be able to explain things clearly, especially when talking about important matters that involve me. When I hear about a disaster, I think and feel that it is somehow my fault. In certain situations, I'm afraid of losing my self-control and doing embarrassing things. Now notice with that, if you were to ask that person, well, did that ever happen to you? They would probably say no. Right? People who worry on a Sunday morning they're going to stand up and start yelling curse words. To feel that urge, and that's a lot to resist. But generally, people are not actually doing those kinds of things. While driving, I sometimes feel an impulse to drive the car into someone or something. I sometimes have the impulse to steal other people's belongings, even if they are of no use to me. I feel like I have to make special gestures or walk in a certain way. I invent useless worries about germs and diseases. So that's a list of 60 different questions, and you would go through and endorse, okay, scale of 1 to 4 or 1 to 5, how intensely is this true of me? And then based on that, you can get some idea of how intense is this person's experience. Another one, and I can put this back on the table for you to look at if you're interested, it's called the YBOC, the Yale Brown Obsessive Compulsive Scale. And I won't read all of these, but I will talk about some of the categories. When we think about obsessions, they often lump themselves or they often manifest themselves in a variety of categories. So there are aggressive obsessions, fear that I might harm myself, violent or horrific images, fear of stealing things, fear of harming others. Those are aggressive obsessions. Contamination obsessions, this would be more the concerns about coming in contact with poison like we saw in the video, or bodily secretions, or sticky substances, touching doorknobs, picking up germs. Those are going to be more contamination obsessions. Sexual obsessions. So sometimes people will have images that come into their mind of perverse or sexually violent images. And you can imagine how distressing that would be to have those peculiar images coming into your mind. Sometimes I've had the experience, if there has been an addiction to pornography, for example, where somebody has engaged in that kind of a process for a number of years and seen a lot of those images, even in a case where they've done well and gotten counseling for that and accountability and done good work, and they're no longer engaging in that addictive process, those images are in their mind, and the OCD can kind of attach to that and pull those images into their mind. So it's not part of the addictive process, and we'll talk about that later on, differentiating between those two. I have also seen people who there was not a history of pornography. They've not engaged in sexually inappropriate behaviors, and so there was no reason for them to have those images in their mind, but the OCD manifests in that way. Sexual images, violent or disturbing in other ways, that are coming into their mind that they don't want. So content that involves children or incest, homosexuality, or sexually aggressive behavior. There are hoarding, saving obsessions, and we could probably talk about that for a while. There's a difference between somebody who has a hobby and likes to collect rocks and somebody who has a hoarding obsession. A hoarding obsession, there is an anxiety-related process that's going on. If I don't get this and maintain it, something bad is going to happen. And so I've got to find as many of these things as I can, or I can't throw as many of these things away as I should, because it's trying to manage anxiety. So that would be more the hoarding obsessions. Religious obsessions, and we'll talk about that in the last session. So concern with sacrilege, blasphemy, did I commit the unpardonable sin, those kinds of obsessions. Need for symmetry or exactness. Remember seeing in the video, so walking on tiles, I can't step on lines. I don't know if you ever walked down the sidewalk and done that, where it's like, okay, I'm going to see if I can step over every two cracks, right? Well, that can be a fun game to play. But if you can't walk down the sidewalk without stepping over a crack, then we begin to say, so what's going on? Probably some of you, if you're on this, the mild end of this spectrum, have had the experience of sitting in church and you're listening to the sermon and your mind begins to wander and you start to see shapes, or you start to see patterns emerge as your vision kind of blurs and you look out at people, you see patterns and shapes, or you see somebody's dress or shirt and your mind begins to make a particular shape out of that. Anybody have that experience? Okay, common experience. It doesn't mean you have OCD, but these are the kinds of things that our mind can do, and when that becomes obsessive, it can become a problem. So somatic obsessions, concern with illness or disease. You can have people whose brains will fixate on, oh my goodness, I have cancer, or oh my goodness, and they'll go to the doctor over and over again and do tests, and there's nothing there, but their mind is fixating on that. Cleaning, washing compulsions, checking compulsions. So it's a very common one. Locks, stove, did I harm somebody? I had a client once who was worried that when they were driving down the road, their car had thrown stones and scratched somebody else's vehicle. or maybe scratch the mailbox, and so they would turn around and drive back and forth on a particular section of road where they thought this might happen to make sure that there was no car scratched, or those are checking compulsions. And then repeating rituals, so rereading or rewriting something. You saw that on the video, did I get this right? Concern for exactness, and so doing it over and over again. These are main categories that obsessions will tend to locate themselves on, the anxiety will attach to. And so an assessment like this, you can download this off of the website. I mean, online, I think this is available. If it's not, when you go to a counselor, it might be a tool that they would use. I don't use this to diagnose OCD. I use this more to get a sense of, I shouldn't say I don't use it to diagnose OCD. I don't use it as the only way to diagnose OCD. I need to have a clinical understanding of the person. So I don't want you taking this home and saying, now I can diagnose OCD. But as a people helper, you can go down over this and say, so what is your mind getting stuck on? And you'll begin to see these categories emerge. To diagnose somebody with OCD, they need to have these obsessive categories, obsessive things that are going on in their mind, and they need to have compulsions. And the DSM-5 says that they need to be engaging in these obsessions and compulsions for at least an hour a day. And then it says, or, unless the clinician decides that it's clinically significant and causing enough distress, you don't have to have it for an hour. So, all we're saying by that is, it needs to be causing the person a significant amount of distress. It's not just, you know, oh, I check the stove twice before I leave for church in the morning. And so the rest of this assessment talks about time occupied, how much does it interfere with your life, the distress caused by these particular thoughts, and then resistance against the obsession. So how much have you tried to resist them? So I will put that on the back table if you want to look at that amongst some other things to get a bit of a sense. So we're looking at the person's life as a whole, and then I'm trying to get a sense of, are there distinct obsessions that are going on? Are there compulsions that they're using to lower that anxiety? And how severe is it? Is this actually getting in the way of their relationships, their ability to go to work, their ability to leave for church in the morning? So one individual that I worked with had particular rituals around getting dressed. And so the family would be trying to leave to go somewhere, and this person's upstairs in the bedroom trying to get decided, what am I going to put on? Now, you all know that experience, going to the closet, am I going to wear this, am I going to wear this, I like them both, I can't do that. But you make a decision and you go on. If you had obsessions over, well, if I put this on, then people are going to think that I'm too dressed up. And if I put this on, they're going to think I'm too casual. And that drives my anxiety crazy. And so I'm going to stand here and spend a half hour. Now you see we have an obsessive compulsive process going on. So I want to understand, what are their obsessions, what are the compulsions, and how severe, how intense are they? After I begin to get a sense of that, and when I'm doing that, I'll say, tell me about your life, tell me what it's like, what are the thoughts that come into your mind? Because sometimes with OCD, they don't have the process identified, they don't know. They just know that, you know, yeah, when I walk down the sidewalk, I do these funny things, or, yeah, you know, I brush my teeth for a really long time, and I feel bad if I don't, and my family gets mad at me. Generally, when people come in for counseling, it's the compulsions that are bringing them in. It's the things that they're doing that to manage that anxiety that are causing problems in the rest of their life. And that's why they're coming in. And then I will begin to help them identify. If we could turn the PowerPoint on again, Ryan, I have one or two slides here I want to put up. Often in a beginning session, after maybe two or three sessions, and I've heard some about their life, and I'm starting to think, I think this is OCD, we go through a process of discovery together. And I'll say, remember, you told me this, you told me that, this thought comes into your mind, and then you did this. Okay, let's think about that and see whether or not that could be an obsession and could be a compulsion. And one of the ways that we do that, it would help if I turned the clicker on, wouldn't it? I'm going to go backwards here to the beginning. Psychoeducation around OCDs, obsessions, and compulsions. After I've begun to get a sense, I think this might be what's going on for the person, then I want to help them identify what are their obsessions and what are the compulsions. I want them to be able to name them. And so we will put this diagram up on the board. I will say an obsession increases your anxiety, right? How do you know if this process is obsessive? This thought's coming into your mind. We all have thoughts that come into our mind. It comes in one ear and goes out the other. If it's obsessive, it gets stuck in there and our anxiety goes up. So how do you identify an obsession? Well, is it obsessive? Is this something that my mind fixates on? And do I feel incredibly anxious as a result? The function of an obsession is that it increases anxiety. And so people say, well, you know, I read my Bible, and we'll talk more about this in religious scrupulosity, but if I read my Bible for a half hour, that's what I do every morning, and sometimes my mind wanders, and I realize, oh my, I didn't remember everything from that hour. And, okay, most of us would say, I read it for a half hour, time for me to go to work, I'm going to move on. If somebody's mind obsessively fixates on that, they feel so anxious, they feel like they have to read it for another half hour. I had a client come in, and his employer was concerned because he was showing up late at work. Well, we find out what's going on is he's reading his Bible for 2 and 3 and 4 hours in the morning trying to get this thing right. And it's an obsessive compulsive process. And then he's late for work and apologizing to the boss but can't explain what's going on. An obsession increases an anxiety. A compulsion brings the anxiety back down. If your mind is fixated on, did I focus on scripture reading enough? And you read another verse compulsively, that anxiety will come down very quickly. Neurochemically, I don't know what all is going on in the brain, but it's probably better than popping a Xanax. You know, it's very effective. People feel relief when they engage in that compulsive thought process, whether it's checking, washing hands, reading scripture again, whatever it is. That lowers the anxiety. The uncomfortableness inside of you goes away. It's like silencing the fire alarm that's going off. You know, I like to say that anxiety is the fire alarm in the brain, right? They don't make fire alarms to be soothing music like you play to your baby and those little things that spin above the nursery, you know, the lullabies, lullaby, lullaby. You never hear a fire alarm that sounds like that. They make fire alarms intense. Ah! You know. And why is that? Because we want people to get up and do something about it, right? In the hospital when they would say, over the loudspeaker system, the fire alarm is going to go off. This is just a test, you know, in 5 minutes. And so the fire alarm would go off. And then it would stop. And sometimes I would say, well, if you do this often enough, we're always going to think it's a test. And then it won't work anyway. But they design fire alarms to elicit a particular response inside of us. Anxiety is the same way. It's a God-given alarm system that says, look, you got to watch out. Something's not going to go well here, right? You're ramping your bike off the roof. You ought to be a little worried about what's going to feel like when you hit the bottom. The problem is, with OCD, our mind gets fixated on those particular obsessive things that we're worried about, and it's like we can't quiet the anxiety down. We can't stop it. And so then we engage in that compulsion, and it brings the anxiety down right away, but it's just for a moment. So, while it's very effective, it doesn't help things over the long run. And it's only a minute until that next obsession comes into your mind. Oh my, but maybe I touched a germ now. Or, oh my, I read my Bible for another 15 minutes, but my mind wandered during that time as well. And so I want to help them identify what is an obsession, what is a compulsion. And so I'll write them up on the board. Maybe I will touch a germ and make a family member deathly sick. Maybe I didn't turn off the light. So you had this thought, and your anxiety went up, and your mind fixated on it, and then what did you do? Well, what we do are compulsions. So I went and washed my hands, or I started counting to 10. Counting to 10, like, is the door locked? And so I'm going to go over and I'm going to look at it, but I find out, I look at the door and I see that it's locked, and I walk away, and the thought comes, but maybe you didn't see it right. So I turn around and I look again, and yes, it's locked. So I turn around to leave, but maybe your mind wandered and it was really unlocked. And so I go back. Now I really want to focus this time. So to make sure I'm focused, I'm going to count to 10. It's locked, 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 it's locked. Whew, okay. I went through that process. Now I can know that I actually looked and the door is locked. And then the mind will play the trick and say, well, okay, but you counted to 10. Maybe you got distracted. Maybe you missed one of them. And so now we have to go and do this counting process. It sounds kind of funny, but it's sort of a torturous process, right? Engaging in that compulsion makes me feel better for a moment, but it's only a little while until my mind generates another obsessive thought. And so our goal is to learn to bring that anxiety down without engaging in a compulsion. That's the definition of an exposure. We're going to expose ourselves. I'll talk more about this, but we're going to put ourselves in a situation that increases your anxiety, generally related to one of those obsessive thoughts, and we are going to hold that intensity, hold that anxiety, without engaging in the compulsion. I'll talk more about that when I get there. Before we do that, I want people to have some coping skills for managing that anxiety. If we throw them into an experience that is physiologically overwhelming before they have any ways of calming themselves down, it's just going to reinforce the compulsion. They're going to want to do that compulsion again, or they're going to lose it. So this is one of the ways where I think an exposure can go off the rails. If you don't teach self-calming techniques, or if you don't help them to learn to regulate that anxiety in healthy ways, and then we push them into an exposure without the ability of knowing how to do that or what the process is, it can overwhelm the system. The story of a lady who was having a harm obsession, that she was going to take a knife and stab one of her children. Very troubling particular obsession to have. And she learned about exposures somewhere. I don't know if she was in counseling or what. She thought, I'm a courageous person. I am going to do this. And so she's walking through the mall and she looks over here and here's a knife store. And so she thinks, well, this is my opportunity to expose myself to this anxiety-provoking experience and not engage in a particular compulsion. So she went in and she asked the proprietor, give me the biggest knife you can possibly find. And so he reaches over and, you know, picks out this big, I don't know what it was, this big, huge knife. And she says, now I'm going to pick this thing up. And so she picks it up. And that experience, when she picks it up, her mind, in her mind, she's seeing herself using that knife to stab one of her children. And it was way too overwhelming. She dropped the knife, went running out of the mall, ended up vomiting in the parking lot because her body was way too overstimulated. And so this is why when we are working somebody through this process, before I expose them to these particular stimulating things, I want to teach them some skills for calming their body down. And that's on my next slide. I think you have these in your handouts. But we're going to talk about rating their anxiety on a scale from 1 to 10. And you say, well, how does it help to know how anxious I am? Right? If I'm anxious, I don't want to know I'm anxious. So if I say it's a 10, now what are we going to do? Well, when you rate your anxiety on a scale of 1 to 10, if I were to say to you, how anxious are you now? 1 is, or a 0, I'm completely at rest. I feel fine. I'm not anxious at all. 10 being a panic attack. My heart is racing. I'm getting sweaty hands. I'm hyperventilating. I feel like there's an elephant sitting on my chest. I feel like I'm going to start screaming. I feel like I might die. My body is taking over and I don't know what to do about it. That's a 10. So if I were to ask you all to rate your anxiety right now I don't know what you would say, one or a two maybe, if somebody's dealing with some anxiety for a variety of reasons, maybe higher than that, but pretty low. When somebody is dealing with anxiety and they put a number on it, it externalizes that experience just a little bit. And I know that's a big word, externalizing. It takes the experience from what I am feeling inside my body and it allows me to stand back from it just a little bit and say, this is something, an experience that I'm having. This is something that's happening to me, and I can actually put a number on that, 0 to 10. And so just the process of saying, my anxiety is at an 8 or a 9 right now, slows their processing down a little bit and helps them to stand back from it. And then, as we move along, I might say, I want you to do a body scan now. I want you to notice, where do you feel that anxiety in your body? Start with your head. Any tension there? Notice your shoulders. Pay attention to your chest. Are you breathing fast? Are you breathing slow? Do you feel pressure on your chest? Tingling in your arms if the anxiety gets bad enough? Okay, now we're just going to move your body around a little bit and try and loosen some of that up. This body scan is not going to make the anxiety go away, but it does help them again to step outside that process just a little bit. So we've rated it. Now we're going to do a body scan. Where do you feel the anxiety in your body? And then we're going to do some of these coping skills. Progressive muscle relaxation, if they have done a body scan, they're set up to be able to do some progressive muscle relaxation. All that is you pick a muscle group, the same ones you just did in that body scan, and you tighten those muscles up, hold it for 1 to 2, 3 seconds, let it go. Tighten it up again, hold it for 1, 2, 3 seconds, let it go. And then you move down, do your shoulders. Do your chest. And you have to do this with people. You can't just tell them to do it because they will go home. It's like, well, what did they say? But if you do it, you know, you can kind of laugh a little bit. It looks funny to squeeze your face up and hold it and then let it go and tighten your muscles up. But you do this with them and their body begins to get a feel for what that relaxation process is like. The other thing this does is it begins to get their mind off of the obsessive process and put it onto the relaxation that they're feeling in their body. Deep breathing. People roll their eyes. Oh, we hear this all the time, right? They teach this to the Marines because it's a way of physiologically controlling particular processes in your body. When you get anxious, your body feels tense. There are certain processes that go on, and that body communicates to your brain, danger, danger, you need to worry about this. And so the mind worries, and the body says, see, I told you there was something to worry about. And yes, I'm really anxious. And so then it intensifies those physiological processes, which creates a feedback loop to your mind. And so this is why anxiety can feel like it spirals out of control. When you do deep breathing, and you say, okay, I'm going to intentionally choose to build some tension in my lungs and then let it go out. You're saying to your body, it's safe. This is okay. I can relax here just a little bit. And it reverses that anxiety spiral that is going out of control. And so we'll do this in the office together. Name and talk back to the OCD. I'm going to talk more about this when we get into some of the other coping skills. I will, if it's a child, sometimes if it's an adult, I will say, I want you to give your OCD a name. Call it Fred. You can picture him like a parrot sitting on your shoulder. Rock, 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 you know. And if it's an adult, sometimes they'll giggle at me and get uncomfortable and say, no, I'm not going to do that. I say, okay, well then just call it your OCD and picture that your OCD is sitting on your shoulder. If you don't want to talk about a parrot or a chicken or, you know, whatever. But children kind of get onto that. And adults do sometimes too. They've come back with some pretty creative names sometimes for their OCD. So OCD, you can sit on my shoulder and you can tell me that I need to wash my hands. But in reality, all you can do is make me uncomfortable and I don't have to listen to you. And so we're creating this narrative where now the anxiety is not just an experience that they're in the middle of, it's something we're externalizing, we're giving a name, and it's something outside of them that I want them to begin engaging differently than, I've just got to wash my hands in order to feel okay. You with me here so far? So name and talk back to it. And we will talk about some other ways that you can talk back to it. Appropriate scripture and prayer. I will say more about this when we get to religious scrupulosity, differentiating how we read scripture and how we pray. I'm not going to talk about that now. But if this is a person of faith, somebody who loves the Lord, I want to know what scripture verses are particularly calming to them, what stories from scripture, what images from scripture, and I want them to incorporate that into some of the coping skills that they can use. They can quote that scripture in this place, assuming that allows them to shift into a space of being more relaxed. Sometimes scripture and prayer is part of the compulsive process. Jesus, forgive me. Jesus, forgive me. And then, no, we're not going to do that. So we have to learn how to differentiate from that. But I have found scripture and particular ways of praying that I'll talk about later to be relaxing and calming for people. Rate the anxiety again. Again, this is putting a number on it. And often what I'll find here, if somebody's really anxious in my office, thinking about one of these particular obsessions, and we do some of these coping skills, especially the deep breathing, and they put a number on it after we've done it, that number will be lower than it was when we started. So if they said 7 or 8, we do some of these coping skills, we get the anxiety out a little bit, and then they do some deep breathing, it'll be down to a 6, 5, maybe a 2. It will never be a 0. I shouldn't say never. Rarely have I seen it go down to a 0. But think about what it's like to know, oh, I can bring this anxiety down just a little bit. It's not going to be this train that runs away with me that I have no control over. And just being able to lower it a little bit builds a sense of confidence, a sense of empowerment. There's something here that I can do. So we rate the anxiety again and then shift. In the obsessive-compulsive process, when the mind fixates on a particular thought, the tendency is to try to get that thought to go away or to do something to neutralize it. And so it's a very different process to say, I'm going to rate this anxiety, I'm going to calm my body down a little bit, and then even if that obsessive thought is still there, I'm going to shift and do the next thing. And so we'll talk about when this obsession comes up, what is it that you were doing and what do you need to go back to? I need to go wash the dishes now. I need to go get dressed. I need to get my shower. I need to go do the next thing at my job. Where we're intentionally saying, I'm not going to make this obsession go away, but I am going to physically move my body and go do the next thing, even though this anxiety is still kind of back there and the parrot's sitting on my shoulder and he's still yakking at me and I still feel a little uncomfortable. It's not as bad as it was. I'm not going to do that compulsion, but we're going to shift and go do the next thing. This is a list of coping skills that I want to teach right up front, and we will talk about other coping skills. I don't mind if they only do a few of these. Sometimes people will say, well, the muscle relaxation, I don't like that one, but the deep breathing, I really do like that one. Okay, that's fine. As long as they're able to do something to bring that anxiety back down a little bit without engaging in the compulsion. And I do kind of insist that they do the rating before and after because I think it's pretty powerful to recognize this is my level of anxiety, this is what I'm going to do to bring it down, and now this is the number that I'm putting on that. Okay, so you have those coping skills in your handout. I will start by helping them to identify what are my obsessions, what's the thought process that's getting stuck in my mind, and then what are the compulsions, what are the things I'm doing to bring that anxiety back down, and then what coping skills can I do instead. So we want to begin interrupting that process. Under self-calming techniques here, I have safe space. This is a practice that trauma therapists will do, and I have found sometimes it's effective in lowering anxiety. I will ask a person, where is a place that you feel safe? And guys will say, a particular place I walk in the woods or in my tree stand. And sometimes clients will say, I have this spot in my house that I go, my chair is there, and I can sit, have my coffee, and I have my time there in the morning. That's where I feel safe. I'm not going to be interrupted. I've had clients say it's on the beach or it's in my flower bed. I have a little place that I go. Okay, we're going to step through the five senses. And I'll say to them, right now, in my office, I want you to tell me what it's like to be in that spot. What do you see? Well, your office. No, no. Go sit on the beach. Tell me what you see. Well, I see the waves, and I see some seagulls, and I see... Okay. And then I will say, what are you hearing? Well, I'm hearing the seagulls, and I'm hearing the waves. And what are you smelling? I'm smelling the salt. What are you feeling? Well, there's the sun on my skin. I can feel that warmth on my face. So we go through the five senses, and then I ask them, what are you feeling right now in your body? And very often they will say, well, I'm feeling a little more relaxed. Okay, that's safe space. And psychologically, you can put yourself into that space. When you have this obsession that's going on and you're trying to not engage the compulsion, to say, psychologically, I'm going to go through the five senses, picture being in that place, and you can bring that anxiety down a little bit. Okay, what is a ritual? We're going to go through some definitions here, and then we'll talk some more about counseling process. A ritual is a set of compulsive behaviors or mental processes engaged in for the process of lowering anxiety. So a ritual is basically an elaborate compulsion, right? People can build... Well, like I was talking about, going and checking the door. So you check once, you check twice, and that isn't enough. So now you begin to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 while you're looking at that lock. Showering rituals. So people feel like I have to wash my body when I'm in the shower in a very particular order or I don't feel clean. And so they go through that and they get to the end and they think, well, but I missed one step back there. So they start over again. And the goal here is not to get their body clean. It's probably clean long ago. The goal is to lower that anxiety because they feel dirty because they didn't go through the ritual in a particular process. Does that make sense? So ritual is kind of a compulsion that's gotten long and there's numerous steps to it. I must soap each finger in order 6 times. When a curse word comes into my mind, I must say, Jesus, forgive me. But I don't just say that. I have to say it 3 times, because if I don't say it 3 times, then I feel like, well, maybe I didn't mean it. And often rituals will grow. 3 times used to work. Soon it's 5 or 6 or 8. I must check the door, each door of the house that it's locked at nighttime, and I need to walk around the house the same way, or worse yet, I need to take my spouse along and say, is the door locked? Is the window locked? Is the stove off? You know, and you can imagine if you're the spouse in this process trying to help your person feel better, that can become frustrating, really irritating. We call this reassurance seeking, pulling another person into my compulsions for the purpose of lowering anxiety. Do you think I need to confess to? Are you sure my motives were pure? Can you please say it this way so that I can be sure I'm okay? Please let me tell you what I did for the last half hour so I can be sure I didn't go and kill the neighbor. Right? Somebody who's having an obsessive thought of, I just went and killed the neighbor and that would be awful because I'll go to prison. And so would you let me tell you what I did for the last half hour so that I can convince myself and you can tell me that no, I didn't go kill the neighbor. Scripts. An obsessional story that keeps getting triggered over and over again. For example, you go to Home Depot. You know how when you walk into Home Depot, there's a greeter there that smiles at you and says, hi, can I get you a cart? Have a nice day. And it's supposed to make people feel happy so they buy more. Somebody with OCD looks at them and says, yeah, nice to meet you. And then this obsessive thought comes into their mind. I kind of like the way he looked at me. Maybe that means I'm gay. Right? You see the obsessive process there. So you're walking into the store, and this thought is going, I'm probably gay. Did I like it? Did I not like it? Well, maybe I liked it. How much is enough? Okay, it has nothing to do with their sexual orientation. It's this process gets engaged in their mind. That's a script. And so if that's a script that you experience, it's likely every time you walk into a Home Depot, or maybe every time you think about walking into a Home Depot, that process is going to unfold. And so being able to identify that. Scripts can also be something that you learn to use to combat an obsessional thought or a compulsion. And for example, I may or may not pick up a germ and pass an illness to my family, but I am going to see how anxious I can make myself right now because germs are not my biggest problem. You see what's happening? Somebody could memorize that script and then use it. Instead of engaging in hand washing, they're going to say, I may or may not make my spouse or make a loved one sick, but I'm going to see how anxious I can make myself right now because I know that if I can conquer this anxiety, or I know that's not my biggest problem right now. And so they can learn scripts to engage in instead of the compulsion. Avoidance. Behaviors and thoughts that are avoided because they create an obsession. So if you go into a Home Depot and every time you walk in there, this obsessive process, this script begins, and that's a really difficult experience for you, you can avoid Home Depot, right? We just never go there. And then I don't have that script triggered. That won't solve the problem because it's going to happen somewhere else and you're going to have to deal with it there. But these are avoidance kinds of things. Saying maybe. So I had pretty sure this was a client with OCD. Client with OCD that came and I said, oh, it's a beautiful day outside, right? You know, it's been raining, and you say, and they say, well, maybe. And I'm thinking, sunny, beautiful, well, maybe, you know. So then we get to know each other and we find out this is OCD. And what's happening inside their mind had nothing to do with the weather. It's like if I say, yes, it's a nice day outside, but he thinks it was only half of a nice day, then I've just told a lie and I can't live with myself because then I'm going to have to go back and apologize to my therapist that I just said a lie and I don't want to have to deal with that. So I'll just say maybe. Do you see the processes that are going on inside the person's mind? And so they walk in and they say, nice day outside. And well, maybe, you know, okay, what's going on here? Like, I want to understand that. It might be they like rainy days, but it could also be an OCD process. Exposure and response prevention works by the process of habituation. So once we've identified the obsessions, we've identified the compulsions, now we're going to design exposures. We've taught coping skills so they have the ability to bring their anxiety down. We are going to help them learn how to design an exposure. An exposure is intentionally putting yourself in a situation that causes anxiety. It ought to be related to one of their obsessions. Think about somebody who washes hands. We're going to say you wash your hands for 30 seconds, and then you're not going to wash your hands, even though thoughts about germs come to your mind for the next 2 hours. Right? And if somebody is deeply entrenched in OCD, their anxiety is going to go up, boom, just like that, in your office. I had a young man who his particular fixation was that he was going to listen to country music. And his family had this rule, I think it was bigger than that, his church had this rule, you don't listen to country music. And so he was worried that he was going to turn on the radio in his, he worked at a place of business where he drove equipment that had radios in, and he had actually taken the fuse, right, out so that he couldn't turn the radio on, but he was still having this obsessive thought, country music coming into my mind, I don't want that happening. And so I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. I want you to go home, and you can blame it on your counselor. I have yet to see somebody who died from listening to country music. I don't like country music. I don't think you should listen to country music. Okay. But I want you to put that fuse back in the tractor, and if you're worried about, you know, have the deacon come over and do it with him there. And you're going to reach up, you're going to turn this radio on, and you're going to listen to, turn it, tune it, to a country music station. I want you to listen to country music for 2 minutes and then turn it off. And you can take the fuse back out. You can give it to the deacon if you want, so he knows you're not going to do that when you're... You know, I was worried he was going to get out of his chair and leave my office just thinking about it. We hadn't turned country music on. The anxiety went up so... And that's kind of a beautiful thing. I mean, I pitied him. But then we could talk about, okay, so what do you want to do right now? And what is your typical compulsion? What do you feel like? And what are we going to do instead to bring that anxiety back down? So that's designing an exposure. And it was an imaginal exposure because he wasn't even doing it. Now, he begged permission for me. He said, well, can I do that without putting the fuse back in? So I'm not actually hearing it. I said, let's try it. So he went home, turned the radio on. I don't remember whether he had the deacon come over or not, but the fuse wasn't in. And he said, I sat there and just turned the radio on, you know. And anxiety goes up. You do something to calm it down. And I realized, oh, that wasn't too bad. You know, so I do it the next day. And do it the next day. And eventually, it wasn't that long, he got to the place where he said, well, I'm not worried about that anymore. You know, but that thought doesn't come to my mind. Now, in this case, when we design an exposure, the process of exposure works by habituation. And I think I have that in my notes here a little bit somewhere later on. But I'll talk about habituation. So if you take a snail, they've done studies like this, and you take a pin and you stick it in the snail. You know, kind of mean. I don't know where animal rights people were when they do this. But you take a snail and you stick it. And when you stick a snail with a pin, what does he do? He jumps. Right? So you poke it again. He jumps. Poke it again. And he jumps. Eventually, you will get to the point where he jumps a little bit less. A little bit less. A little bit less. And you can poke the pin, you can prick the snail, and he won't even move at all, right? It's called a process of habituation. And I would imagine, I haven't tried this, but I would imagine you could do the same thing. You could probably take a pin and poke it until it doesn't hurt as much anymore. That's the process of habituation. That's the way anxiety works. And so what we do is we create this anxiety. I tell my clients, we're going to hunt for the anxiety. We're going to see if we can hold that anxiety for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. So in the case of this gentleman who was worried about country music, right, we can increase that anxiety in our office, and then we'll say, now let's see, what is it? Well, it's an 8 or a 9, it's a 10. Okay, now we're not going to do any of our coping skills this time. Let's just see how long we can keep you anxious. Oh, I don't know how long I can stand this, right? And you stay there for a minute or two, and generally it will start to come down. Why? Because our body isn't meant to hold that level of that anxiety for a long time. Osborne, who is a psychiatrist here that wrote Tormenting Thoughts and Secret Rituals, I think he says generally, if people can manage for 15 or 20 minutes with that high level of anxiety, it will come down. Rarely is it ever beyond an hour. You think, oh my goodness, anxious for an hour. Most of my clients, it's been a number of minutes till they notice the anxiety coming down. And if I see that anxiety is amping up, and I'm worried that they're going to crash or something bad is going to happen, I'll say, okay, we've taught these coping skills, let's bring this anxiety down now, right? We can do that without engaging in the compulsion. And then we'll come back and do the exposure again. But again, the process of habituation is holding that level of anxiety when you're in their presence, when you're with them. You heard about the touching the tree, the leaf, and then a berry, and then the tree, right? She was worried, if I touch this tree, I'm going to get poisoned. And so you're slowly increasing the level of anxiety that they can tolerate around this particular obsession until it comes down and they learn that they can tolerate it. So exposure and response prevention works through the process of habituation. We can do that by actually doing it. We can do that imaginally by just being there in our mind. Creating a recording of the dreaded outcome and listening to it on a recorder over and over again. Write a story in the first person of the dreaded outcome and listen to it over and over and over again. Now, I haven't used this particular one with clients, but I do know that there are OCD therapists who do that. So if there is a particular thought that comes into your mind that's troubling, You can say that. They have these repeatable tapes that you can buy, 2 minutes long or 3 minutes long or 20 minutes long. And you can say, I did this to memorize things when I have poems when I was a kid. You'd say the poem over and over, and then you listen to it when it doesn't stop going. You can create that phrase that comes into your mind. Maybe I didn't read my Bible enough. Maybe I didn't read my Bible enough. Maybe I didn't read my Bible enough. Maybe I didn't read my... If I said that for 5 minutes to you here, probably some of you would get up and leave. But the rest of you, when we repeat a word over and over and over in our mind like that, our mind deconstructs it, and it no longer has the same meaning. It's just a bunch of sounds that we're experiencing. And so what we're doing there, what that process is, when we're creating that recording, we're actually teaching our body, we're taking the meaning out of the thing so that it's not creating that level of anxiety. Other exposures that you can design. Touching a toilet seat and not washing your hands for 2 hours. Intentionally taking your sandwich and putting it on the floor, take the lunch meat apart and put it on the floor, pat it around, put your sandwich back together and eat it. Anybody feeling anxious? Taking your shoe off, after you've walked in a public place and kissing the bottom of it intentionally, right? Now, when you think about touching a toilet seat, and this would be illogical, right? Most of us have picked up our cell phones today, and they say there's more germs on your cell phone, the average person's cell phone, than there are on a toilet seat, because we wash a toilet seat down once a week or every day, depending on whether you have OCD or not. You don't wash your cell phone down with a disinfectant. I don't know if I've ever done that, right? But that isn't going to solve the problem of OCD. I mean, we can know those things. I'm just saying, that might help a little bit if you're worried about germs and you want to kiss the bottom of your shoe. Intentionally stating a script. I may or may not be responsible for causing harm to a person that I love, but I am not going to do this compulsion because I want to feel the anxiety and I want to beat the OCD. And so when we're designing an exposure, if somebody's in my office, we're going to try and see if we can make that level of anxiety go up. And then we're going to see if we can tolerate it till it starts to come down. And when they do that, that's an empowering kind of an experience. And then we say, okay, you're going to go home now. I want you to practice this. And we're going to talk about how it went. Often what I will find is, I think we're supposed to take a break here at 2:30, yes. 10 minutes and then we'll take a break. Often what I find is when people begin to engage this process, a particular obsession that they're working on is going to go away, and they won't struggle with that anymore. But the anxiety will move, and it will attach itself onto another obsession. So if they are worried about germs, for example, and they conquer washing their hands, the anxiety will move to something else. Now they're worried about washing dishes in the sink, and that will go on forever. Or it'll go to a completely different category, and they'll start worrying about whether or not they need to confess something, or whether or not their faith is strong enough, where they've committed the unpardonable sin. And so I find that working with OCD is a recursive process, right? They conquer an obsession, they feel good about that, and then they come in and it's moved to something else, and we say, see, what you're recognizing now is that this really wasn't about the germs. It's about this process that's going on in your mind, and I want them to get the feel for what that process in the mind is like. And once they've worked through a number of obsessions, they'll begin to contextualize and be able to say, oh, I know what that feels like. It felt that way here. It felt that way here. It felt that way here. And now my anxiety is attaching to this. Oh, I know what to do. And they can begin to design their own exposures. They can begin hunting for their anxiety. When a client comes in and says, yeah, I was thinking about this, and so I thought, well, I got to make myself anxious. I'm going to go do this. Then we start cheering, right? Because they're learning the process. They're recognizing in their mind what's going on and designing their own exposures. I didn't talk much about a hierarchy. Sometimes when we are designing exposures, I think that's in here somewhere, I'm losing my place in my notes, but that's fine. We will say, okay, let's talk about particular obsessions, and we'll make a list, 10 of them. I am worried that I didn't read my Bible enough. I am worried that I might have committed the unpardonable sin. I'm worried about hand washing. I am worried about whether or not I turned the stove off. We'll make a list of all those obsessions, and then we will list them in the order that they produce anxiety. So how anxiety-provoking is it if you don't wash your hands? Put a number on that. And then we will order them in the order of what's least anxiety-provoking to the most. And we'll start designing an exposure around the obsession that's least anxiety-provoking and help them conquer that. And then we will go on to the next one. Does that make sense, how I'm thinking about that? And slowly move up. Okay, differentiate between content and uncertainty. You with me in the notes? Am I jumping around too much? Exposure to the uncertainty and not the content. Content is a means to the anxiety to allow for habituation. I want people to begin understanding when they're talking about obsessions and compulsions that it's not the thing you're worried about that's the problem. That's the content, right? The anxiety that's caused by that particular obsessive thought is the problem. So, for example, with hand washing, it feels like if you touch something, I pick up my water bottle or I touch a doorknob and now I have a germ, and I'm worried that I might make somebody sick. It feels like the problem is that germ that I just might have picked up. Does that make sense? The problem is not the germ. The problem is that anxiety, the fire alarm going off in my brain at a level of intensity that I can't control and that I need to bring back down. And if I can understand that, the problem here is the anxiety that I feel inside. It's not the germs. It feels like it's the germs, but it's actually the anxiety. And if we can differentiate between those two, because they learn about that thinking process, then they can begin to, on their own, say, I'm feeling anxious about this. I'm having this obsessive thought that's getting stuck in my head. Maybe I'm not a believer. Maybe I committed the unpardonable sin. That's not actually the problem. That's the content that's creating the anxiety, but the anxiety is the problem. It's not that. So learning to help people make that differentiation between content and uncertainty. Well, that frees you up then to only read your Bible for a half an hour instead of worrying, I need to be reading it for more, 2, 3, 4 hours. We can set a limit to it. The problem is not scripture reading. The problem is the anxiety that's caused when I feel like I didn't read it thoroughly enough. And so once they recognize that, then they can begin using that content, whatever the obsession is, to create the anxiety and start the process of exposure and habituating to it. Remind yourself, remind the client, that the obsessions are not a reflection of one's true character. This is particularly important when we're doing exposures to harm obsessions. In the case of a harm obsession, and this is a quote from Osborne, the OCD sufferer must be taught and reminded again and again that obsessions are not part of one's basic personality. They have no bearing on who the person really is, and intrusive, violent thoughts are normal for the human race. Many people have had thoughts, what if I would hurt somebody? What if I would kill somebody? What if you and I have those thoughts? They come in one side, they go out the other, and we don't think about them again. Somebody with OCD, that normal human process, their mind fixates on it, and then they begin to say, so I must be something wrong with me. I must be a bad person. And so they need to be reminded over again, especially if we are going to create an exposure around that particular obsession, right? The next time that thought comes into your mind, I want you to sit with that thought. Maybe I will kill my father. What's the image that's coming to your mind? What are you going to do? They need to be reminded that if I'm going to ask them to do that, to be present with that thought instead of resist it and run from it, that this is something their brain is doing to them. It's not who they really are. They're not a violent person. People with OCD rarely, I could probably say almost never, act out their obsessions. I don't mean people with OCD never do something violent, but generally they're not violent people. And if they do something violent, it's not because they're acting on those obsessions. There are other things, generally speaking, going on. So we don't need to worry that them being present with this particular thought that's coming into their mind is going to make them do it. And so I want you to sit with that. You can tell me what the image is in your head. Tell me how uncomfortable it makes you. And now let's see if we can hold that anxiety till it goes down. If we're going to ask them to be present in that, we need to say, this is not about who you are, right? This is a process that we need to teach your brain. Coping skills utilized by Osborne groups. If you buy this book, I'm not trying to get you to buy Osborne's book, but if you do, these are in there. These, he held groups for people with OCD and then collated what are the things that were most helpful coping mechanisms for coping with these obsessive thoughts without engaging the compulsion. So these are more coping skills that you could teach somebody. Ignore the obsessions. I can have this thought and still be okay. Maintain the thought instead of resisting it. OCD can make this difficult, so you might need to use humor. Well, that's a silly thought. It's no big deal. That's kind of like static on the radio. Or a suitor who won't take no for an answer. I won't ask how many of you have had that experience. You know, you're kind of nice, but it's like, keep your distance. Yeah, I see you, right? We can develop that kind of a relationship with our OCD to sort of bring some humor into it. A rational argument. You can't reason your way out of OCD, but when I was talking about that coping skill where you talk back to the OCD, you talk back to the parrot sitting on your shoulder, you can use some of these rational arguments. Yeah, Freddie, I know you're telling me that I might make somebody sick, but generally you've told me that for the last 3 years and it never happened, so I don't need to listen to you this time. Just because it feels real doesn't mean it is. I want to overcome OCD. I have to feel this anxiety as intensely as I can. Just a silly, stupid brain burp. I'm not going to let this thought win. All I have to do is try my best and move on. No one else has to act like this. And you have to be careful with some of these. You know, you don't want to shame people, but if they can use it themselves and talk back to the parrot, that's entirely appropriate. If it feels like OCD, it's probably not real. And we'll talk more when we get to religious scrupulosity, differentiating between what's real and what's not. It's not me, it's OCD. This thought that I'm having is a neurochemical problem in my brain. My brain doesn't like to process fears. If you give it a name, a chicken or a rooster or a parrot sitting on your shoulder, you can kind of develop a relationship with your OCD. Poor Fred. Should I give you a tissue? I'm sorry to upset you like this, but no, I am not going to let you make me do my compulsion. It's okay if you have to cry. You know, you can start talking to your anxiety in that way. Take control, stand up to the OCD. I am not going to let OCD ruin my day. I'm going to make a plan and I'm going to follow through and I'm not going to let my thoughts interfere. We are at 2:30, but we're going to go over just 2 or 3 minutes to get through the rest of this coping skills here, and then we will shift and come back to the rest of this. Whatever happens, happens. I'm going to do the opposite of my compulsion, and whatever happens, happens. Remember the stories of other people with OCD. So if you know other people who have had this experience, you can remind yourself of them. Trust in the Lord. My trust in God is bigger than my obsessions and my compulsions. And Osborne quotes a 14th century prayer from The Imitation of Christ. My Lord and God, do not abandon me. Remember my need, for many evil thoughts and horrid fears trouble my mind and terrify my soul. How shall I pass through them unhurt? How shall I break their power over me? You have said, I will go before you. I will open the gates of prison. Do, O Lord, as you have said, and let your coming put to flight all wicked thoughts. You can develop your own prayers. We'll talk more about that in our next session. Limit or postpone a ritual. lead an active life, accept that OCD is a chronic disorder. So for many people, they will struggle with OCD for a long time, maybe the rest of their life. But it doesn't need to be at the same level of intensity. It doesn't need to interfere with their life. I have seen clients work in therapy for 6, 8 months, maybe a year, and come to a place where they're able to live and they recognize the OCD process, they know how to manage it, and it's no longer interfering with their life. And I can tell some stories about what that's like. Okay, we will come back to OCD and warning signs in the family, and I also want to talk about how do we design exposures to things like pornographic thoughts or other things that we don't want people to be fixating on. I want to get that because that is a common experience that can happen. So if I forget that, please remind me, and then we will talk more when we come back about religious scrupulosity and how to engage that process.